Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Wednesday, August 25th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a partly sunny day today, with a high of 89 degrees, winds south-southeast 4 to 8 miles per hour. Tonight we can expect a strong late-night thunderstorm. Winds will come out of the northeast, then, from 4 to 8 miles per hour. Our low will be 69 degrees. Looking around the region, we see partly sunny today, a strong thunderstorm late tonight. Storms can bring flash flooding and damaging winds. Let's take a look at the stories on the front page. COVID-19 cases in Iowa keep growing. UNI honors Native and Indigenous people. And we will begin reading Waterloo Police Investigate Fatal Shooting. Man was slain near area Quick Stop 3 on Tuesday afternoon. Shooting victim collapses, dies on Waterloo Median. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz and opens with a photograph of a blue car with police surrounding it. The caption says, "Police are investigating a shooting that broke out near a convenience store on Washington Street, Highway 218 in Waterloo, as heavy storms passed through the area Tuesday, August 24th, 2021. Waterloo. Police are investigating a fatal shooting that broke out near a Waterloo convenience store as heavy storms passed through the area Tuesday afternoon. Details weren't available, but witnesses reported someone shooting in front of Quick Stop 3, 1104 Washington Street, with a person running into the Highway 218 median and collapsing, and a vehicle leaving the scene. Multiple squad cars from Waterloo Police and the Blackhawk County Sheriff's Office responded, as did Waterloo Fire Rescue paramedics. Officers found a deceased man with a gunshot wound in the median. Authorities blocked off all southbound lanes of Highway 218 and rerouted traffic into nearby neighborhoods as police gathered evidence. The identity of the deceased hasn't been released, and an autopsy will be scheduled. Anyone with information is asked to contact Waterloo Police. Next is a story filed by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. COVID-19 spreads in Iowa, with almost 2,200 new cases added in just one day. The spread of COVID-19 is continuing to ramp up in Iowa, with almost 2,200 new cases recorded on Saturday. Not surprisingly, the county with the lowest vaccination rate in Iowa is also the county with the highest number of new infections over the past week when adjusted for population. According to the New York Times, the number of new infections reported Saturday was 2,197, a sharp increase from last week's single-day high of 1,992. Saturday's total was Iowa's highest single-day tally in 7 months, since 2,478 new cases were recorded on January 6th. Throughout August, the trend line for new infections in Iowa has been climbing sharply, mirroring a trajectory last seen in early November 2020. The current trend line shows no signs yet of leveling off. In Black Hawk County, the 14-day average positivity rate was at 14% as of Tuesday, up from 13.8% less than a week ago on August 18th, according to the County Health Department. The number of new cases reported on August 18th was 59. On Tuesday, that number was 145. Even more telling, the 7-day average of new cases, which tends to be a more reliable measure of trends than single-day tallies, is also on a sharp upward trajectory. On July 9th, the 7-day average was 39 new cases per day. Today, the average is 20 times higher at 814 new cases per day. Adjusted for population, only 13 other states currently have a higher number of infections than Iowa, which presently has 12,525 cases per 100,000 residents, according to the Washington Post. Iowa's 7-day average of hospitalizations due to COVID-19 is also climbing and stands at 491. That's a 54% increase over the past 2 weeks, according to the New York Times' data. Hospitalization in the state are at the same level now as they were in late January. The counties that saw the biggest gains in hospitalization when measured against their overall population were Lucas, Madison, Polk, Ringgold, and Warren counties. Despite the current rapid rate of increased infections, the raw number of newly infected Iowans remains far less than last November, when Iowa sometimes topped 4,000 new cases per day. The total number of current COVID-19 cases in Iowa stands at 849, a 42% increase over the past 2 weeks. The hotspots in Iowa, along with number of cases per 100,000 residents recorded in the last 7 days, are the following. Davis County had 54 cases per 100,000 residents. Lee County, 52 cases per 100,000 residents. Ringgold County, 50 cases per 100,000. And Crawford County, 48 cases per 100,000 residents. Statewide, 51% of Iowans are fully vaccinated, which places Iowa close to the national average. There are 23 states with a higher percentage of fully vaccinated residents. The Iowa counties that have the lowest percentage of fully vaccinated residents are Davis County, Decatur County, Van Buren and Lyon counties, and Sioux and Wayne counties. The Iowa counties with the highest percentage of fully vaccinated residents are Johnson County, Linn and Dubuque counties, and Polk, Boone, Dallas counties. In the past few weeks, some major national employers, including the Department of Veterans Affairs, Google, the Mayo Clinic, and the military, have begun requiring vaccinations. The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has also advised all public and private nursing homes nationwide that if they expect to continue to be funded by Medicare and Medicaid, all of their workers must be vaccinated. Earlier this year, Iowa state lawmakers banned local mask mandates. President Joe Biden has pushed back on that measure and similar actions in Iowa and 7 other states. The U.S. Department of Education sent Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds a letter last week voicing opposition to the state's restriction on local mandates, but Reynolds has held firm in her support of the measure. Andy Malone filed this next story. UNI honors Native and Indigenous people with celebration. The story is accompanied by several pictures of Native American men wearing colorful traditional costumes. The University of Northern Iowa intends to honor the culture and heritage of all Native and Indigenous people with a statement. That work to develop its mission stewardship statement continued with a celebration Tuesday evening featuring Larry Yazzie of the Meskwaki Nation, who shared tribal dance and music inside Strayer Wood Theater. Quote, "No matter where you come from, be proud of who you are," said Yazzie. Quote, "Be proud of your roots that you carry with you, the blood that you carry with you," unquote. In July 2020, UNI President Mark Nook met with the Meskwaki Tribe Council, quote, "recognizing that there was an opportunity to better live the university's mission by strengthening the collaboration and work we do with Native and Indigenous people," according to Andrew Morse, Nook's chief of staff. The statement is expected to be released by Indigenous Peoples Day on October 11th. One goal of the statement is acknowledging UNI's presence on land formerly stewarded by members of the Meskwaki Nation, the Sac and the Fox Tribe of the Mississippi and Iowa, and additional Native groups. The Meskwaki settlement in Tama is the university's closest active Native and Indigenous organization in the Cedar Valley, Morse said. Quote, "We became serious a year ago," Morse said. "We're ready now to do a stewardship statement that will guide our work for years and generations to come," unquote. Yazzie, who is touted as a world champion fancy dancer, took to the stage in his traditional regalia and shared some of his moves as well as his flute music. He also spoke about his experiences from high school. Quote, "It was very challenging during those times because we encountered discrimination," he said. "We encountered racism, but we endured. So I stand here tall and proud of who I am. I know where I come from. I still try to learn as much as I can today about my roots, about my history." Quote, "I use music, I use dance. I use this stage as a platform to deliver a message to the world. We need to recognize our indigenous people, indigenous communities, not just here in North America, but all over the world," unquote. During Yagsi's presentation, he selected people in the audience to join him on stage, and he gave a dance lesson. Following the dance, which he says is a way to express your spirit and also keep in shape, he asked for thoughts on how they felt. In addition, this evening, campus leaders shared their thoughts and ideas from closed on-campus listening sessions that will play a role in shaping the university's mission stewardship statement. Quote, "We want to make sure our Native American and Indigenous students know that they belong, and we will do our part to make sure they are included in our diversity, inclusion, and social justice initiatives," said Chiquita Loveless, UNI Interim Director of Diversity, Inclusion, and Social Justice. Members of the Meskwaki Settlement, Ho-Chunk Nation, and Great Plains Action Society took part in the festivities and education, as well as a few Native American and Indigenous students who intend to create a campus organization to promote similar ideals. Quote, "We want more to acknowledge that we're here," said Tiernan Wanatree. Marley Whitefish added, "and that we still exist," unquote. According to Ezra Papakee, they want to educate others about their traditions and heritage and reach out to other schools to get involved. Previous attempts have been made to create the organization, Papakee said, but some of those engaged students graduated and there wasn't enough of a commitment from everyone involved. In addition, she noted that there wasn't always assistance offered by university faculty and administration. Quote, "We will do our part to make sure this happens and provide everything necessary to make sure they can succeed," Loveless emphasized. Later in the evening, a new UNI Gallery of Art exhibition of work by Native and Indigenous artists, co-curated by UNI alum Angelica Weiselkuk, opened. The exhibit, titled "The Earth is a House of Stories," draws from UNI's permanent collection. Jeff Reinitz filed this next story. Heavy storm downs power lines, causes multiple fires in Waterloo. And it begins with a photograph of a Waterloo Fire Department truck near a downed power line that's hanging over a parked car. Waterloo. A strong thunderstorm moved through the Waterloo area on Tuesday afternoon, downing power lines and trees. A fallen branch dropped a charged electrical line on a sport utility vehicle traveling on Ridgeway Avenue near West 9th Street, trapping the driver and a passenger inside before crews were able to remove the wire. At about the same time, lightning struck a house in the 3200 block of West 4th Street, dragging down another service line and sparking an electrical problem that began to melt circuitry and release smoke inside the home, said Battalion Chief Ben Peterson with the Waterloo Fire Rescue. Firefighters were called to a similar downed line with smoke in the basement at an Adrian Street home, as well as a brush fire on Homer Street. After the storm hit around 2:15 p.m., Waterloo firefighters went to 31 calls, including 15 to 20 downed lines and four automatic alarms that turned out to be false alarms, Peterson said. Surrounding communities in northeast Iowa also saw heavy storm damage, including southwest Fayette County. There was roof damage in the city of Olwine, grain bin damage along Highway V-62, and a damaged hog confinement on Highway 281, according to the Fayette County Sheriff's Office. Turning the page now, we're in the Cedar Valley section, and today's includes the Call the Courier column. Question. The construction on West 4th Street near Cholas is going very slowly. When is it expected to finish? Answer. November 1st, weather permitting. Question. How many accidents have been reported on the intersection of Byron Avenue and West 9th Streets? In the last 5.5 years, there have been 5 reported accidents at this intersection, 3 property damage only, 1 minor injury crash, and 1 possible unknown injury crash, according to Sandy Greco of the city's Traffic Operations Department. Question. Why has it taken over a year to complete the sewer substation project on San Marnin and Kimball? Answer. The contractor of this project experienced difficulty with the boring of the new force main under Amond Avenue. This required a city-executed change order and new means and methods to complete the work. In addition, supply chains for materials vital to this project were delayed due to COVID-19 shutdowns, according to Brian Bauman of Waste Management Services. Question. Will Cedar Falls be spraying for mosquitoes this year? Answer. No, Cedar Falls will not. The city has not sprayed for mosquitoes in over 30 years. Question. Is the Pat Morrissey that is on the Waterloo City Council the same Pat that is wanted to change the name of Waterloo Columbus? Answer. Yes. As we've reported in the past, Morrissey is a graduate of Columbus High School. Question. Why aren't you covering the crisis at the border? Answer. We've printed many articles about the influx of immigrants at the southern border, including items on Governor Kim Reynolds' decision to send Iowa State patrol troopers to Texas to help with the humanitarian efforts and act to help conduct high-visibility patrols. Question. You stated that Dysart Road was not under construction. It actually is, 5 miles north of Dysart, and will not be open until mid-November. Answer. Sorry for our mistake. We were looking at Dysart Road in Blackhawk County. Apparently there is a closure in Benton County on V-37 Dysart Road, 2 miles south of Hickory Hills Park entrance. Question. I heard the Hippodrome and some other buildings at the Cattle Congress are going to be torn down. Why is this? Can't they be saved by the Historical Society? Answer. The National Cattle Congress is in the early planning stages of possible renovations to the fairgrounds. Quote, we're looking at a major change here, a pretty big overhaul that will benefit Waterloo, according to Jim Koch, NCC General Manager. There is no timeline at this point. Officials are still open to input, and plans could include restoring and refurbishing some buildings. Quote, we'll always keep the history in mind, Koch said. The idea of re-imaging the fairgrounds was presented at the city's Spark Waterloo event June 8th. Question, whom can you contact to get speed bumps installed on your street? Answer, if you believe a speed hump is warranted in a certain location, contact Waterloo Traffic Operations to get details on the process required before the City Council can vote on whether to install one. And for this column, calls are taken on a special courier line at 234-3566. Questions are answered by courier staff. Now, the next article on this page was filed by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Inspectors cite Tokyo Bay in Waterloo for numerous food safety violations, and the story opens with a photograph of the exterior of the Tokyo Bay restaurant. Waterloo. Tokyo Bay Japanese Steakhouse and Sushi Bar is among a number of restaurants and grocery stores cited by state and county food inspectors in the past month for numerous food safety violations. On an August 5th visit to Tokyo Bay, an inspector reported that, quote, due to numerous foodborne illness risk factor violations today, the person in charge needs to review what their duties and responsibilities are in this facility, unquote. Among the violations found by the inspector was a large tub of pasta cooked the previous day in a walk-in cooler and was measured at 56 degrees, having not yet reached the required minimum holding temperature of 41 degrees. Additionally, there was no date marking process in place for foods prepared on site, and four large trays of eggs were sitting on a shelf by the grill and were being held at 78 degrees and had to be discarded. Cooked chicken, cooked tempura shrimp, and vegetable items were being held at room temperature and had to be discarded, and a large plastic garbage can was being used to hold washed lettuce without being sanitized before each use. The inspector also found several bins of cooked pasta prepared in recent days that were not date marked, and the staff was unclear as to which of them had been prepared first. The findings are among those reported by the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals, which handles food establishment inspections at the state level. Listed below are some of the other serious findings that stem from the 1,000 inspections at Iowa restaurants, stores, schools, hospitals, and other businesses over the past 4 weeks. Two Sumner eateries were cited by inspectors. At Nina's Cafe 93, an inspector during an August 4th inspection cited the restaurant for raw poultry that was stored above ready-to-eat items and a contaminated food preparation board where chicken was cut. Sauces that were labeled as needing refrigeration were stored at room temperature, and food items were found that had no date markings. Additionally, quote, many food safety errors, many violations, were noted by the inspector, but not specified. The inspector reported that no sanitizer buckets were set up in the kitchen, and wiping cloths were being reused without any sanitizing solution. Many plastic containers that were meant to be single-use containers were being reused, and the area around the mop sink was very smelly and was infested with many flying insects. Also, the ventilation hoods were heavily soiled and dripping with grease. During an August 11th visit, an inspector cited Thunder Lanes in Sumner for having many food items that were not adequately protected, an apparent reference to construction dust and debris caused by a remodeling project that was initiated at least 2 years prior to the inspection. The report also noted, quote, missed opportunities for hand washing by the staff, many violation and repeats that were not specified by the inspector, and foods that were not properly date marked to prevent spoilage. The inspector found mold in door gaskets and a food preparation board that smelled greasy and was heavily soiled with blackened growth. In her report, the inspector also noted there were many gaps and openings around the building and said walls and ceilings were incomplete, and the flooring was broken up in a number of areas. She noted vast areas that might harbor pests and pointed out that there was a large amount of rodent droppings found in cupboards and around the grilling area. She cited construction dust throughout the area, as well as soiled clothing, food containers for to-go orders that were improperly stored, plumbing that was in a state of disrepair, exposed ground and gravel in the interior of the building, a large amount of general debris, flooring that was marked by greasy buildup and old food particles, and mouse droppings that had not been cleaned up. The establishment, quote, needed to be thoroughly cleaned, the inspector wrote. The State Inspections Department reminds the public that their reports are a snapshot in time, and violations are often corrected on the spot before the inspector leaves the establishment. For a more complete list of inspections, along with additional details on each of the inspections listed below, visit the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals website. Other establishments cited include these: the Bohemian, 1024 3rd Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids. During an August 5th inspection, the restaurant was cited for holding butter, sour cream, sliced ham, chicken wings, and chopped chicken salad for more than 7 days. Also, several items on the walk-in cooler were not date-marked. Red cabbage was stored by raw meat. Baked potatoes were sitting on a tray left at room temperature and were about 60 degrees. workers were not washing their hands at appropriate times, and short ribs that were thrown in a warmer were holding at 120 degrees and had to be reheated to 165 degrees. Three Samurai, 1801 Second Street, Coralville. During an August 10th visit, inspectors cited the restaurant for 20 separate risk factor violations, which is an extraordinarily large number of serious violations tied to a single inspection. Among the violations, a food worker was handling cooked appetizers with his or her bare hands while placing them on customers' plates. Milk was being held at 50 degrees, and cut lettuce was being held at 60 degrees. A cooler was unable to maintain proper cold handling temperatures. The dishwashing machine was not reaching the required temperature to sanitize dishes. Sushi rice that must be disposed of in a timely fashion was not marked with the preparation time and had to be discarded. There was no designated person in charge who was present in the restaurant. House-made perishable foods stored in coolers were not date-marked and had to be discarded. The person in charge of the restaurant appeared to have no knowledge of time and temperature controls necessary to ensure food safety. Cooked fried rice was holding at room temperature on a kitchen counter, and no one could say how long it had been there, and there was dried food debris on the food slicer, although it had not been used that day. The inspector also noted other violations that did not fall into the category of serious risk factor violations. Among those, frozen raw salmon was left on a counter at room temperature to thaw. Multiple containers of seasonings and sauces in squeeze bottles had no labels. A cook was working without a hairnet, and the scoop used to pull ice from the ice machine for customers' drinks was stored on top of the ice machine. The inspection was classified as a routine inspection, but stemmed from a complaint that the inspector ruled was unverifiable. Many of the violations were of the same nature as those cited during the last routine inspection in 2019. Tasty Tacos, 6326 Mill Civic Parkway, West Des Moines. During a July 29th visit, an inspector observed that the sanitizing fluid mixed to clean dishes and utensils was too weak. The beans held in a food warmer were averaging 111 degrees to 127 degrees, which was too cool to prevent spoilage. The meat and bean mixture prepared the day before was not date marked. The steak meat next inside a reach-in cooler was covered in foil and should have been placed in a freezer. The back door near the employee's storage and kitchen areas had visible air gaps. There were no test strips available to check the chlorine-based sanitizer, and there was no handle for the hot water faucet in one of the bathrooms. The inspection was conducted in response to a complaint from a customer who had reportedly become ill after eating at the restaurant, but the inspection was classified as routine. The manager told inspector the restaurant had not received any complaints, but did have one reach-in cooler repaired earlier in the week as it wasn't working properly. The complaint was deemed unverifiable. The state inspector wrote in his report that the manager could not provide any documentation showing the restaurant had been monitoring the temperatures of food, and so the use of timers was discussed. The manager indicated he would consider using timers, the report states. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, August 25th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Independence. Stephen M. Kremkes, 69, of Independence, Iowa, died on August 21, 2021, in rural Independence. Steve was born on January 24, 1952, in Independence, Iowa, the son of Matt and Anna, maiden name Weber, Kremkes. He was a 1970 graduate of the St. John's Catholic High School in Independence, Iowa. He went on to Hawkeye Tech to study auto mechanics. On May 3, 1974, Steve married Cindy Hickey at St. John's Catholic Church in Independence. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, August 27, 2021, at St. John's Catholic Church in Independence, Iowa, with Reverend David Beckman presiding. Burial will be held at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Independence. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, August 26, 2021, at the Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. A rosary will be said at 4 p.m., and a parish vigil service will be held at 7:30 on Thursday. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to the Steve Kremkes Memorial Fund at any Bank Iowa location. To leave an online condolence, please go to www.rifefamilycenter.com under obituaries. Cedar Falls. James Peter Jorgensen, 93, of Cedar Falls, died Monday, July 13, 2020, at Western Home Communities, Prairie Wind. He was born March 30, 1927, in Jacksonville, Iowa, the son of Jens Peter and Annie, maiden name Peterson, Jorgensen. He married Phyllis Ray Jorgensen on January 26, 1951, in Jacksonville. She preceded him in death on August 3, 2018. He graduated from Harlan High School and attended Dana College in Blair, Nebraska. He was district manager for J.I. Case, owned and operated Carolyn's Fabric Store with his wife, and later farmed. Memorial services will be Monday, August 30th, 2021, at Fredsville Lutheran Church, with burial in the church cemetery. Masks will be required. For the safety of Jim's 11 great-grandchildren, who will be attending, if you are not vaccinated, please stay home. Online condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Memorials may be directed to the family to be given to Fresh Wind Worship, Fredsville Lutheran Church, and Cedar Valley Hospice. Waterloo. Jodell McDermott Bush, 80, of Waterloo, passed away peacefully in the evening of Sunday, August 22, 2021, surrounded with love of her family. She was born March 17, 1941, in Waterloo, daughter of Joseph and Delphine Schneering McDermott. She was raised by Eugene and Mary McDermott. She received her high school diploma in 1959 from OLVA. She married the love of her life, Daryl Bush, on October 3, 1959, at St. John's Catholic Church in Waterloo. Jodell was known to love everyone. She was especially devoted to her family, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. She found comfort in her faith in the Lord and through prayer. She was a very caring woman with a special love of sweets and animals. She was employed as a teacher's aide at Central Middle School for many years. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, August 26th, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church, with burial in Garden of Memory Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday at Hagerty Wyckoff Grawrup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway. There will be a 4 p.m. rosary. Visitation will continue at the church for an hour before services on Thursday. Memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Hospice. Condolences may be left with www.hagertywyckoffgrawrup.com. Cedar Falls. Noreen R. Roth, 93, formerly of Cedar Falls, died Sunday, August 22, 2021, at Good Neighbor Society Retirement Community in Manchester, Iowa. Noreen was born May 23, 1928, in Edgewood, Iowa, the daughter of Robert and Dorothy Vanter Walker. She married Harold Roth on February 14, 1955, in Waterloo. Noreen was a beautician for 30 years, retiring in 1990. Services will be at 1:30 p.m. Friday, August 27, 2021, at Dahl Van Hoof Schoof Funeral Home, with burial in Gardens of Memories Cemetery in Waterloo. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time. Memorials may be directed to Paula Livingston, care of Dahl Van Hoof Schoof Funeral Home, 1825 West 12th Street, Cedar Falls, Iowa, 50613. Waterloo. Carol Stevenson, 66, of Waterloo and Cedar Falls, died Saturday, August 21, 2021, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Carol was born January 9, 1955, in Waterloo, the daughter of Junior Bud and Eileen Dix Smith. She attended Waterloo West High School. Carol married Steve Stevenson June 17, 1972, at the First Wesleyan Church in Waterloo. She was self-employed as a nail technician out of her home. She also bred miniature schnauzers. Services are 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 28, at Locke Funeral Home, with burial in Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation is 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Friday, August 27, at Locke Funeral Home, and for an hour before services. Memorials may be directed to Cedar Bend Humane Society in memory of Carol Stevenson. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. LaPorte. George Riley Williams, Jr. passed away peacefully at home in LaPorte City, surrounded by loved ones, on August 19, 2021. Riley was born on February 14, 1953, at home in LaPorte City. He graduated from high school in 1971. He later married Terry Schanner in 1973. They had 3 children, Riley, Shane, and Sarah. They later divorced. Riley worked at John Deere for 43 years, retiring in 2015. Riley enjoyed the company of his buddy Pedro and car rides in the countryside. He also loved to fish, golf, play pool, bowl, and play cards. Grave site services at Westview Cemetery in LaPorte City are at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 28th. Celebration of life at the Gateway Bar and Grill at 12 o'clock p.m. following the service. Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts dies at 80. This story was filed by Jim Lawless and Gregory Katz of the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of Charlie Watts playing the drums with the Rolling Stones. London. Charlie Watts, the self-effacing and unshakable Rolling Stones drummer who helped anchor one of the rock's greatest rhythm sections and used his day job to support his enduring love of jazz, has died, according to his publicist. He was 80. Bernard Daudry said Tuesday that Watts passed away peacefully in a London hospital earlier today, surrounded by his family. Charlie was a cherished husband, father, and grandfather, and also, as a member of the Rolling Stones, one of the greatest drummers of his generation, Daudry said. Watts had announced he would not tour with the Stones in 2021 because of an undefined health issue. The quiet, elegantly dressed Watts was often ranked with Keith Moon, Ginger Baker, and a handful of others as a premier rock drummer, respected worldwide for his muscular, swinging style as the Stones rose from their scruffy beginnings to international superstardom. He joined the band early in 1963 and remained for nearly 60 years, ranked just behind Mick Jagger and Keith Richards as the group's longest-lasting and most essential member. Watts stayed on and largely held himself apart through the drug abuse, creative clashes, and ego wars that helped kill founding member Brian Jones, drove bassist Bill Wyman and Jones's replacement Mick Taylor to quit, and otherwise made being in the Stones a most exhausting job. A classic Stones song like Brown Sugar and Start Me Up often began with a hard guitar riff from Richards, with Watts following closely behind, and Wyman, as the bassist liked to say, fattening the sound. Watts's speed, power, and timekeeping were never better showcased than during the concert documentary Shine a Light, when director Martin Scorsese filmed Jumping Jack Flash from where he drummed toward the back of the stage. The Stones began, Watts said, as white blokes from England playing black American music, but quickly evolved their own distinctive sound. Watts was a jazz drummer in his early years and never lost his affinity for the music he first loved, heading his own jazz band and taking on numerous other side projects. He had his eccentricities. Watts liked to collect cars, even though he didn't drive, and would simply sit in them in his garage. But he was a steadying influence on stage and off, as the Stones defied all expectations by rocking well into their 70s, decades longer than their old rivals, the Beatles. Watts didn't care for flashy solos or attention of any kind, but with Wyman and Richards, formed some of rock's deepest grooves on Honky Tonk Women, Brown Sugar, and other songs. To the world, Watts was a rock star, but Watts often said that the actual experience was draining and unpleasant and even frightening. Quote, girls chasing you down the street, screaming. Horrible, I hated it, he told the Guardian newspaper in an interview. Watts found refuge from the rock life, marrying Shirley Ann Shepherd in 1964 and having a daughter, Serafina, soon after. While other famous rock marriages crumbled, theirs held. Jagger and Richards could only envy their bandmates' indifference to stardom and relative contentment in his private life, which included happily tending horses on a rural estate in Devon, England. Author Philip Norman, who has written extensively about the Rolling Stones, said Watts lived in constant hope of being allowed to catch the next plane home. He said little about playing the same song for more than 40 years as the Stones recycled their classics, but he did branch out far beyond Satisfaction and Jumping Jack Flash by assembling and performing with jazz bands in the second half of his career. For much of his career, Watts resisted the excesses of his bandmates, but he fell into heroin addiction in the mid-1980s. He would credit his stable relationship with his wife for getting him off drugs. With his financial future secure because of the Stones' status of one of the world's most popular live bands, Watts was able to indulge his passion for jazz by putting together some of the most talented musicians in Britain for a series of recordings and performances. They typically played during the long breaks between Stones tours. His first jazz record, the 1986 Live at Fulham Town Hall, was recorded by Charlie Watts' orchestra. Others by the Charlie Watts Quintet followed, and he expanded that group into the Charlie Watts and the Tintint. Watts was an acclaimed jazz band leader when he was stricken with throat cancer in 2004. He received extensive treatment and made a full recovery. His return to health allowed him to resume touring with both the Stones and his jazz band. Watts is survived by his wife Shirley, sister Linda, daughter Serafina, and granddaughter Charlotte. The Metro Briefs column appears on this page. Beyond Pink fundraiser set, Cedar Falls. The fourth annual Team Sherry fundraiser sale will take place from 5 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Friday, and 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday at Green Hill Baptist Church, 4316 Cedar Heights Drive. The event is held in memory of Sherry DeBoard Schumacher and raises money for the Beyond Pink team. Due to road construction and closure of the Cedar Heights Drive intersection with Green Hill Road, access is only available from the north. Teachers sought for STEM awards, Des Moines. Nominations are being accepted through October 10th for the annual Iowa STEM Teacher Award. The Iowa STEM Teacher Award recognizes one full-time licensed pre-K-12 teacher from each of the 6 Iowa STEM regions for their passion in motivating their students to develop a lifelong interest in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in and out of the classroom. The 6 teachers selected will each receive an award of $1,500 for their classrooms, with an additional $1,500 for personal use. Any individual can nominate a teacher by visiting iowastem.org/teacherAward-application. Following the nomination, teachers will fill out an application that will be reviewed by a panel of judges. An award recipient from each of the 6 STEM regions will be announced in January 2022. UNI Gallery plans exhibit. Cedar Falls, the University of Northern Iowa Gallery of Art is featuring present tense sculpture, paintings, and drawings by Tom and Malaya Gormley through September 25th. Seattle-based artists Tom and Malaika Gormley will present a public lecture at 6 p.m. September 23rd in Room 111 of the Kamarik Art Building on the UNI campus. A closing reception will follow. All events are free and open to the public. Masks are encouraged but not required. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and by appointment. Symphony Sets Closing Concert, Cedar Falls. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony closes its 2021 summer season of free outdoor concerts at 7 p.m. on September 4th at the New River Place Plaza's Viridian Credit Union stage, 2nd and State Street in downtown Cedar Falls. The concert will be conducted by Jason Weinberger. Joining the symphony for this concert are vocalists Travis and Abby Turpin. The concert is free, and attendees are encouraged to bring chairs or blankets and to wear masks. Now let's pick up one more article from the Cedar Valley section. Amidst changes, Waterloo Schools continues measures to protect students and staff from COVID-19, story filed by Andrew Wind, and begins with a photograph of a school employee welcoming students to school. And the caption says, Evelyn Holmes greets students on Tuesday for the first day of school at Lou Henry Elementary School in Waterloo. Waterloo. Sam Kressig was interacting with a steady stream of students and staff Tuesday morning at Hoover Middle School. The assistant principal stood in a sixth grade hallway as students arrived for school. He conferred with teachers, pointed students to classrooms, talked to one boy about his bus schedule, and complimented a girl on her hairdo. Then, suddenly, the hallway was empty. Quote, honestly, this feels good. We're all settled in about 2 minutes after the bell, he said. The sixth graders were on their second day of classes, but it was the first day for seventh graders, and eighth graders are returning on Wednesday. At Lou Henry Elementary School, which is adjacent and connected to Hoover, it was the first day for second and third graders. Leaving their parents at the curb, the children came through the main entrance, where they were greeted with high fives and cheers from a group of staff members. This, the second year Waterloo Community Schools is staggering the start of classes at all of its buildings, this time over the first 3 days. Last year, starting grade levels on different days was used to teach students routines that helped to separate groups for social distancing due to COVID-19 concerns. It serves a similar purpose now, but is also a more general opportunity for students to get a good start to the school year. Many measures remain in place to protect children and staff from the coronavirus. Quote, obviously, we don't have the hard, fast mandates, said Jake Youngkent, Lou Henry principal, such as a requirement to wear masks, quote, but a lot of precautions are going to be the same, unquote. That includes things like seating charts to make contact tracing easier if anyone is exposed to COVID-19, keeping classroom groupings together in the hallways, and having only one grade level in the cafeteria at a time. Quote, the silver lining, said Youngkent, is we get much more precise with our scheduling. Things just had to run smoothly, and they did. At the middle school, last year officials began having students enter the building by different doors based on grade level. It's one of the things that we learned worked really well that we wouldn't have tried without the pandemic, said Kressig. Hoover principal Amy Schmidt said the school is similarly keeping in place a lot of mitigation strategies. Quote, what we've recognized is COVID is still real, she said. Some changes have been made, though. Lockers couldn't be used at all last year. Now students can use them at the beginning and the end of the day, but they remain off limits during passing time to keep everyone moving rather than congregating. Students are still being spaced out in the lunchroom, but plastic shields won't be utilized. Quote, this year, to me, it looks more like traditional school, said Kressig. The year is starting with sports and other activities occurring, and a lot fewer students are learning virtually from home. Quote, it's wonderful to have all the kids back in the building, he added. Some students expressed similar feelings about their return to school. At Lou Henry, Isabella Love was glad to see some familiar faces in her second grade classroom. Quote, I was hoping I would have some friends in my class, she said. I love seeing friends and was really excited to come back to school. I like all the subjects, really. Hoover, seventh grader, Carly Kammeyer, was also happy to be back for the new year. Quote, I was excited because it was something new, she said. Kammeyer likes to try new things out, like lockers, since we didn't have those last year. She is also looking forward to meeting new people who weren't in school during her first year at Hoover because they were learning online from home. Quote, I'm pretty excited for language arts because I have three of my best friends in that class, said Lander Cooper, another Hoover seventh grader, after initially admitting he wasn't ready to be back at school. Cooper also likes how his lunch period happens halfway through math, which he remembers as the longest class last year. Grady Wirtz, who started sixth grade at Hoover Monday, was still getting used to his new surroundings and a new schedule. Quote, it's been a bit different, just waking up earlier than usual, he said. Sixth graders take classes in a smaller, contained area, but I know the school is huge, and in his second day of classes, Wirtz wasn't sure yet about being back in school. Quote, I'm more of a summer guy, he said. Now we will read the public safety briefs column. Update. Three teens arrested in July shooting that injured 5-year-old in Waterloo. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Waterloo. Three people have been arrested in a July shooting that injured a 5-year-old girl in Waterloo. In a series of early morning raids, Waterloo police detained three 17-year-olds and executed 5 search warrants. Officers arrested DeAndrew Dequan Spates, Deonis Javier Gates, and Tyree Dontell Smith Jr., all of Waterloo, on charges of intimidation with a weapon and willful injury. All three are charged as adults, according to court records. Bonds was set at $50,000 each. Police said they are thankful for the assistance they received from the community in the investigation, as well as other local, state, and federal authorities. Officers found about 30 spent shell casings after 4 people opened fire at a southbound sport utility vehicle in the area of Logan Avenue and Argyle Street around 9:15 p.m. on July 18th. The 5-year-old was struck and taken to Unity Point Allen Hospital, where she was treated for a broken left arm. Witnesses saw 4 people running toward Heritage Apartments, and investigators recovered surveillance video from the shooting, which led to the identification of the suspects, court records state. Shell casings came from 9mm, 40 caliber, and 45 caliber weapons, according to police. The investigation into this matter is ongoing, and police continue to seek and speak with witnesses. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Waterloo Police Department at area code 319-291-4340, option 3 for investigations. Next, Manchester man found guilty of attempted murder of ex-girlfriend, Waterloo. A Manchester man has been again found guilty of trying to kill his ex-girlfriend following a retrial. A Black Hawk County jury deliberated Monday afternoon and returned to the courthouse Tuesday morning before announcing it had reached a verdict. Jurors found Robert Bob Krogman guilty of attempted murder. He was taken into custody. Prosecutors said Krogman shot Jean Smith 3 times with a .44 Magnum revolver at her Dundee home after she refused to get back together with him. The wounds left Smith with lifelong injuries. The defense argued that Krogman didn't intend to kill Smith. Krogman had been found guilty during an earlier trial, but he was granted a new trial on appeal, and venue was changed to Black Hawk County. On the sports page, Cyclones need receivers to step up, filed by Ben Visser, sports correspondent. Ames. Iowa State has plenty of known commodities at the receiver and tight end positions. Xavier Hutchinson was a first-time All-Big 12 receiver. Chase Allen was a second-team All-Big 12 tight end, and Charlie Kolar was an All-American tight end. Still, both positions need players to step up. Hutchinson had 64 catches for 771 yards. The second-best returning receiver was Sean Shaw, who had 21 catches for 212 yards. Hutchinson is expected to have another big season. Quote, to be a 1,000-yard receiver, it's a lot of prep. You have to be healthy, and then he needs to continue to create big plays down the field, receivers coach Nate Shellhass said. Quote, he started doing that more as the season went on, but he also was able to catch the ball short and get yards after the catch. He's as good as any receiver I've been around in terms of yards after the catch. When he gets the ball, he gets a lot more yards than you'd expect, unquote. But the Cyclones need another receiver to help take the load off Hutchinson, and a healthy Tariq Milton might just be the guy to do it. Milton played in just 6 games last season and caught 15 passes for 102 yards. Milton has proven to be a deep threat for the Cyclones. He got injured on a 42-yard reception against Oklahoma. In 2019, he averaged 20.6 yards per catch. If Milton can stay healthy, he's the perfect slot receiver to complement Hutchinson. What Tariq brings to the table is a guy who can threaten people vertically, Shielhaas said. Quote, he's made a lot of plays for us at multiple positions. It's great to have him back, and he brings a whole lot of experience to the receiver room, just knowing the game and understanding defenses, unquote. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, August 25th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. And thank you so much for being with us today.